in Led Zepp, we were a pretty cool band because we kind of didn't do anything the way that everybody else was doing it. We just did things when we felt like it. We wrote quite prolifically at times, and then we'd have periods where nothing happened at all. And then we'd book a tour, and we'd go on tour playing songs that hadn't been released yet. You know, playing Stairway to Heaven to people who'd never heard it was a bit of a trial because it did go on for a long time, and the people were waiting for A Whole Lot of Love, and they got that instead. There was no real technique about how to preserve it, how to make it work, how to stroke this success into something fantastic. There were photograph sessions, which were grudgingly, you know, attended, but we usually hung the photographers upside down in the swimming pool or whatever it was and then just ran off tittering.
The whole thing of why Led Zeppelin was because people saw us taking chances. They didn't want us to be format. I didn't want to be format. It's a thing that I, in the Yardbirds, I started, you know, having that freedom after having been a studio musician where you had to be 100%, 1,000% precision because that's what your livelihood depended on. And when I got out of that, I was so happy to be able to break the rules and do this and do that. And that was good. So I loved the areas of improvisation because that's what kept me on top of it.
We knew what we could do and we'd rehearsed a bit and it felt like it, you know, it was all right. We cut the numbers down a bit. It's the same as the shows. I mean, every tour, I remember the same conclusion at the end of the tour, the same conclusion, like, okay, this time we're going to cut the songs right, keep everything short and crisp and to the point and sweet. And you go out, you do, okay, it's an hour and a half. We'll do an hour and a half show, maybe hour and three quarters. For the first two nights, it would be that. Then the second two nights, it would gone to 2.5 hours. And by the time the tour had ended, you were out like 3.5, 4 hours again.
What?
Yes, that's entirely fair. Jimmy Page, I suppose, being the producer here, pretty much did all the donkey work with the director, Dick Carruthers. I believe Robert and I used to pop in from time to time, see how they were doing. But I believe they searched high and low for footage and bits of bootlegs and just all sorts of things.
We had recorded and documented via 16mm a performance back in 1970 of the Royal Albert Hall. And there was quite a number of disputes over copyright of this material. And in the end, it was sold to somebody who acquired it from one of the cameramen. And it was going to be auctioned at Sotheby's. And in actual fact, at the end of the day, we managed to do a deal with the chap to get it back, even though one of the reels managed to go missing. But as will become apparent throughout this interview, you'll understand why it was so important to have this, because there was such precious little Zeppelin material. But at that point of time, I said that the only way to get this moving is to get everybody in a studio, a viewing studio, because I hasten to add that there was a showreel which had music on it, and then all the rest was just black and white. So I said, rather than, you know, somebody spending hours and hours and hours trying to identify something we can identify in a matter of seconds, let's go in there and we'll be able to identify the stuff. I have storage of Zeppelin material at home, so I know where everything is there, but some of the other stuff had actually gone into official storage facilities, but they'd been moved around over the years. And there's this massive storage facility over near London Airport. And fortunately, well, actually, some of the stuff was sort of missing. And it was really fortunate that there was a chap there who who was a Zeppelin fan who worked there, and he was a massive assistance because he combed the place all over, and bit by bit things would turn up that, you know, you'd have a run of tapes and there'd be a missing hole, and suddenly the hole would fill. Because once I found the eight tracks, it seemed to me that, you know, we could have a full story of the band and the journey and the growth of the band within that. And treat it, you know, what I wanted to do was treat it like a journey, so it moved from venue to venue and fades in and fades across and all the rest of it.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I love it. I mean, just to say goodbye to VHS, I think, is almost enough for me. Surround sound, I think, is fabulous, and this particularly works well in surround sound. I mean, it was when I first heard it in the studio, it was just stunning. It was just, you know, it's just, you just sit back with your mouth open and go, wow, this is really, really good. I think surround sound is particularly appropriate for live work because you have the ambience of the hall around you, and you're in the audience, you know.
That would be something that would be interesting. But it's been a perilous journey. It's a perilous journey, to be honest with you, because once the world of art meets the world of business, it can be very, very tiring, and it can wear you out. So I really have to charge my batteries up before I went on to something like this again. But obviously, the way that the market is going and people are getting home cinemas and stuff, because it's really not so expensive now, certainly isn't over here. It's obviously the way to go, and I really would love to do that, but it would have to be done properly.
When I see Led Zeppelin in black and white, I see it in a naive, action-packed, breathtaking condition. And that's the bit I like. Before I'd learned any of the tricks, before I even got bored, you know, before I even started wondering, where are we, you know? When it was just everything to be singing in that band. And I look at that early Zeppelin, and I marvel because it was just so positive and constructive and exciting. It was like a real roller coaster ride, which, you know, in my wildest dreams when I was singing Roll Over Beethoven in some dump in the Welsh mountains when I was 16, little did I know that I'd have anything to do with Whole Lotta Love when I was 22.
I must say, I did have a sort of concept for it, and that was for us to be walking up we had a shot of us walking up the stairs backstage at the Royal Albert Hall, and as this was going to be 5:1 digital, and, you know, in fact, a facility that we you know, is if we'd have done this 4 years ago, probably wouldn't have been available, you know, not to the point where people have got, like, these home cine units now. So, obviously, it's done in stereo as well, but to have this 5:1, so I thought it'd be great to have us walking up this little door that walks onto the stage and then have the sound just coming right round you, just as though you had that perspective of being one of the members walking up. And then at the end of it, I knew that the audience started singing You'll Never Walk Alone at the end of Nebworth, and I thought, what a lovely way to start it off and end it.
The thing is, it sounded so good. I mean, it just sounded tremendous, and it sounds now so fresh. And those are the things that I know are true. You know, my vision of what it was at the time was it was 110% of my life. And I grabbed it, and I caressed it, and made love to it, and hated it, and then I bought it drinks. It was my life, you know. And now looking back at it, it almost seems like, woo! What a guy. Look at those guys.
It doesn't feel that long. Only about, I suppose, a year in the actual making of it, perhaps. I mean, it's actually come together quite quick, you know, like a few meetings for artwork and that sort of stuff. So it's, I think we came, something happened, we came across some Albert Hall footage, I think. That's what started it. And we thought, this looks great. We must, what can we do with it? And I think that's when the ideas for DVDs and stuff. And then we started looking for other things to accompany it.
Working from 7 to 11 every night. Let me tell you, let me tell you, let me tell you, it really makes a lot of drag. I don't think that's right.
We really weren't in the mould of anything that was going before, you know? And so it presented a bit of a problem. There was no... We had done television performances, and that's included in the menus of this DVD. And you can see sort of what we were up against. Danish TV is sort of fun for what it is, but you can see that the audience are absolutely terrified because they've never heard the like of anything like this before. And, you know, they're sitting down and they don't get up, and it's quite amazing. There's this French show that we did, which we only used basically part of the show. One of the numbers really is in its entirety, but you can see us playing in front of like a Salvation Army audience that are sitting there waiting to do their part. And I remember they had all silly bits where there was a chap dressed up like a hall porter peeping through a peephole and things, and it was like a comedy bit. And then during the broadcast, even though we did a sound check of it, they're turning up the level of Robert Plant. And the band's going down and all of this. And quite clearly, we couldn't be portrayed in this sort of way as a band that was doing these amazing live performances. And so we took the decision not to do live material on television, not to be seen to be heard through a 2-inch speaker, because you've got to remember the technology on TVs was pretty dire and grim and appalling in those days. So that was it. We decided to stand up and be counted purely by live albums and live appearances.
Now, I don't remember too much about it, except I couldn't wait to get out because it was just so odd. And I think they wanted us to do things. And, you know, like, not sketches, but something, I don't know, they wanted us to do something stupid and everybody just went, "That's not." That was good. It was good, Australia. The half full of people that turned up really enjoyed themselves. Half full gigs have... You go one way or another. You get really depressed that nobody's shown up. Or you get really relaxed and just play extremely well. I think that was one of those nights.
I don't really know what the terms of it were, whether we got paid or whether it's supposed to be for a TV... Well, especially obviously a TV thing. And I remember we went down there, and whoever was directing it really wasn't au fait with Zeppelin at the time, because I think they were all waiting for Stephen Stills and maybe Buddy Miles or whatever, all these sort of characters coming in from the States. And we had to sort of sandwich ourselves between everybody else's equipment. And we were prepared to play two numbers, but they only wanted one. We did Dazed and Confused. I said, "What about Communication Breakdown?" "Oh, that's not necessary. Don't worry."
Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman was created below. I like it!
No, he's, you know, he was a bass player's dream, really. Not only was a drummer, he was a musician as well. You know, there are two can be sometimes different. Having said that, you can say that about any instrument, but he really knew what he was doing, and he listened, and he had such feel, such a soul. And we just worked really well together. Plus, he was always funny. I mean, he was a very humorous man, and very generous man, and so he used to go crazy, so did we all. But no, he was a joy to be with on stage. He really was. I just loved playing with him.
Well, it's tough because, you know, I mean, he and I came from the same area. I still live there. Pat still lives there. Jason still lives there. Everybody's around. And it's like, it's a bit like waiting for Ulysses to come home, you know? And time flies. And it's just, time does fly, you know? Everybody's busy doing what they're doing. And to look back now, I think, whoa, we didn't really know that much. To actually have that much energy and to create that much excitement within ourselves, we didn't really know that much. I mean, the etiquette of general manhood and stuff, you know, we're still wet behind the ears. So it's kind of cute, really. You look back and go, ooh, hey, guy. As far as film catching performance and no sort of collages or tricks or little side issues, I think just walking up those steps onto the Albert Hall stage and starting off in such a compulsive and absolute fantastic energy with We're Gonna Groove is the moment for me. And that's the beginning of everything. I mean, it's just like, whoa, to get into something which is where the three guys are just playing as one, they're turning corners together. It's, you know, it was like amazing. And it was just about the song. It lasted 3.5 minutes. And it was so amazingly exciting.
But it's such a magical place to play. The history of it alone goes back to Victorian times. And you know, it's got this stage. It's got a pipe organ at the back of it that goes from the stage to the top of the building with the pipes. And then it's got these boxes that are tiered all the way up. And it's phenomenal. Just the whole history. For me, playing at the Albert Hall, it was such a milestone for me to actually play there at this place that had so much musical history.
It was probably the first big gig on home territory. It was quite exciting because everybody that we knew was there. You know, everybody's families were there, and there was kids and dogs. But I thought the performances were good, and there's a lot of energy on the stage. It's great. I was just watching some last night again. I was thinking, this is great stuff.
From Led Zeppelin 1 to 2 to 3, they're all incredibly radical changes of tempo, of insinuation, of the root of everything that we did, and the forces around us were changing all the time. I was visiting Morocco, and Jimmy and I had been during that time to India together and recorded in India. We spent some time in Thailand. We were feeling, in our passage for musical development, we were mixing with all sorts of different cultures, which is really crucial because the stimulation in the music was phenomenal, you know?
As far as I was concerned, when we played in America, we always played, and you know, without any doubt, with all the stops out, we played at our best. The mean average of any concert was always at a fantastic quality. But when we got to LA, we always seemed to be playing at our best. And I actually, it was my suggestion to do this recording on the West Coast because, hey, we had LA Forum. And if anything did go sort of slightly wrong, we had the backup of the following night. And I just figured that we'll go out there and we'll really capture everything that's going on with this incredible audience that were willing you on to just perform, you know, incredible feats of magic. And one did. One, you know, one supplied them accordingly.
Now, this is the strange thing. There weren't that many shows on tape. Unfortunately, we were hot in both those shows. And I mean, that was the joy over people's faces listening to this stuff, thinking, we were really on, too. You know, that was when we were the best, which is why I came up with the title, How the West Was Won. And in 5.1 as well, that they sound really, really stunning.
Just something that had never been done before was to, not that I knew of anyway, was to have something that was really atmospheric, that would, it would start and creep into the auditorium. And really it was just like a bow, you know, I used to bow the guitar in Dazed and Confused, but to bow it acoustically. And so that the whole thing would start opening up with this really, really weird sound. And because people wouldn't know at all that it was a bowed guitar. And then it would be in exactly the same key as the first number we were starting with, Immigrant Song. And that was it. It set the scene for A Magic Night. Even though the numbers are similar on How the West Was Won, the performance is dynamic, absolutely dynamic. There's no two ways about it. The performances on the BBC sessions, for example, we're doing Stairway there, and nobody's heard it because the album hasn't come out. That's why the applause is so light, because they really don't know what it's all about. But what I can tell you... Oh, and also on the BBC sessions, there's maybe three different versions of Communication Breakdown, but they're all different. And that's the thing about Led Zeppelin, was that you know, this, it's so noticeably different. There might be subtle differences across two nights. Sometimes, across two nights, there'd be radical differences.
Yeah, it was almost as a bit of an intermission, in a way, you know, from the hard-rocking stance. And, well, as I said, it was a different position. It had chairs along the front of the stage. You could sit down. I mean, it was still work for me because I had to play bass pedals as well. I always had to do and sing. You know, like everybody was just sit down one, and I'd have three things to set up, get mics in the right place, and you know, change instruments a dozen times. And so I used to have sets of bass pedals all dotted around the stage, wherever I was. I could, if I was playing something else, I'd have to play bass as well.
Made up my mind, make a new start. I'm going to California with an ache in my heart.
It was a really fine time and a fine moment, and I think that we, for a while, at the time of Physical Graffiti, we were right on top of it. We weren't looking for hits. We didn't give very much thought to whether or not success was an issue. It was just, we were really quite prolific. And tunes like The Wanton Song and Trample Underfoot and Custard Pie, these things would just appear as great little diamonds, just sparkling and fantastic moments. There was such a freedom and a coherence between the players. And I would just gambol like some kind of, I don't know, other guy, just whipping through these things, coming up with melodies, taking a little bit from the blues, adding a bit of innuendo, a bit of humour for Sick Again, you know, and just making some kind of camp social commentary of the times.
The American audiences were, without doubt, at that time, the best that we'd ever encountered. You know, they were just so enthusiastic. And that was at the end of a tour, you know, those ones in Madison Square Garden. So they just built and built and built. And, of course, it was just fantastic. I was up for 5 days during the whole of the recording of that and the playing of all the concerts, because we did more concerts there than, you know, we did quite a number there. And I remember I had no sleep. It was the end of a tour.
Thing I remember about that, which is of interest to probably nobody but myself, is I had my own grand piano there, which I was going to take from my house and send it to Steinway. And I thought, I'll put it on stage first and then send it to Steinway to be fixed. And it's great having your own piano for no quarter. It was a big open air festival. I remember arriving by helicopter. It's the second show I've ever arrived by helicopter. The first one was in the Bath Festival. But, yeah, Nebworth, it was good to do it again, I suppose. There were doubts as to whether we were going to carry on, I think, around that time. Robert had some extraordinarily horrible luck with his family, and we, you know, it was toe in the water again, I suppose. But I think they were good shows. I had that huge machine. You kind of rode rather than played. It was a Yamaha GX1, the dream machine. Stevie Wonder had two. I remember that. He was always way ahead of technology with everything, and he had two of them. I think I got rid of mine. I think I sold mine to Keith Emerson, who also had one. I think I replaced it with a sofa. Basically, I'd got that machine, and Robert and I got to rehearsals early, and and we kind of, by the time everybody else showed up, we'd written the album. And so it was definitely going in that direction, because it inspired a lot of the songs, just sitting there playing it, you know, which is kind of what used to happen. I mean, that's how, just to go back to the acoustic set, yeah. You know, I'd bought a mandolin, and Paige was playing more acoustic guitar as well, and so acoustic songs appeared, you know, everything was pretty organic. Or if I had a synthesizer, you know, In the Light came out, and, you know, that's... And it was nice, you know, the instruments inspire and situations inspire. They all had their highlights, you know. On the one hand, the very early tours where everything was new and everything was exciting, and the sort of the whole melting pot of the band and the forging of the music, and that was just very, very exciting times. On the other hand, towards the end of the Zeppelin career, you know, the things like The Private Plane is one hell of a way to tour. It really is the only way. I preferred, I suppose, the smaller, the arenas to the really big stadiums, although the odd really big stadium was fun. I don't know, as long as we were on stage, we were pretty happy. It didn't really matter where that stage was.
It's very strange to look at it now, because at the time, one would never have thought that it would have been reviewable. It was just what it was. To look at it now and give it any kind of title or any kind of credence or any kind of reflection is something so far removed from what was happening in those days in 1970. You know, I mean, it could have all been over by the fall. It could have been gone. I'd have made a great car salesman. But, you know, I mean, nobody knew what was happening, you know, so the idea of scrutinizing it now is almost wrong. It's almost better to leave it exactly where it was and just say, hey, look at this, this is what they were doing. Mm. Talking about it, it's a bit spooky, really.
When the numbers were written and then were in their sort of embryonic stage, and then they were born, basically, at the time that they were recorded, and there'd be overlays and filigrees, and, you know, to enhance them and to give different colours to the basic song. And it would achieve its identity, and it would go on an album, and it would be placed amongst others on purpose, wherever it was. But once it hit the road... Once it hit the road, it would start to take on a totally different personality. It was just like, it was growing on the road.
Well, you see, Tolkien His inspiration for the book, or at least the geographic inspiration, was from the area where I live. And there is, in fact, a place called Baggins Wood. It's only about 8 miles from my house. It's amazing, yeah. The whole idea of good triumphing over evil in such a way by using naivety and using a central character like Frodo. Frodo lives. He should still live today, you know? My little lyrical inserts were kind of coy accessories, you know, because at that time there was a whole generation of Americana was into that, and I was into it too.
Well, between that and Kashmir, Stairway covers a lot of ground. Yeah. You know, you have the acoustic, you have a slight jazzy feel in the first verses. The whole dynamic thing, the whole map of the song is just very Led Zeppelin. I mean, we used to do whole shows which you could transcribe onto that map of that song, you know. It had everything there.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's mining the stairway.
Kashmir was written from my angle. It was written on the road to Tantan in southern Morocco on the Atlantic, just off the Atlantic coast. And it's a place where your mind can really dance and where your imagination is way open. After a while, all the stuff you've ever thought about has gone. And you've got this whole different place that's giving you a sort of door into a whole different you. And so I set to work on this song that would bring an air of optimism and an air of searching and an air of not mystique, abstraction, epithet, whatever it might be. And to combine it with such, I would say, not gargantuan, but it's very, very proud music behind it. Jimmy did turn up with the majority, if not all, of the Rain Song. And that was really quite something. And it developed in such a classy way. The sound of the recording, the sound of the kit, the bass, the way the song moved and breathed, the mellotron, which is just that little bit out of tune, you know. It was a smoky song for a smoky, you know, jazz lounge in a way, except for it wasn't. It was just so pretty. And I heard it and I went, well, what do I do there? You know, you can't do Run Around Sue to that. During the making of Zep 4 and Physical Graffiti, we stayed at a place called Headley Grange, which is where we used a mobile recording truck. And by putting the tie lines through windows and stuff, we cut some amazing sounds. And it was where the famous When the Levee Breaks drum sound was born and developed, which went on to change the world, really, and gave a lot of people a hell of a career later on, a generation further on down the line. And this house had got one resident goat. It was an old workhouse that was supposed to be haunted and this, that and the other, but in fact it was just a tired house that needed some love. And with the tired house and the tired furniture and the peace and the ability to work came one old black dog, who I think was quite deaf, but insisted on following me everywhere I went. And the dog followed me everywhere, and he was my old pal. It's so simple, isn't it, really? It's got nothing to do with a woman moving well.
for all of us there. We've got like the DVD one, and you've got that, and then you've got this little interlude where you're going through on from the Immigrant Song with the Showground, and then all of a sudden it goes wallop, Hey Hey Mama from Black Dog, and you can really see how we have come on in just a very short period of time, how whereas we're really concentrating on everything on the Royal Albert Hall, by now we've got so much confidence that we can actually move around a lot and still be improvising and doing the whole thing, you know, the confidence was just growing and growing and gaining and gaining. Yeah. As each year went by. Some people thought that it was just compiling. Yeah. For me, it was a real production, but it was great. It was great. I knew it was going to be epic, and there was one point when I went, oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. But I knew that if you just kept focused, it would all come out, and it would all fit into place. And then as it did, it was just pure magic. People are slightly confused maybe about it, but what it is that what the music that's on the DVD and the locations that are there don't appear in CD form, and that what is on How the West Is Won is compiled purely from these two concerts in 1972 on the West Coast, and that's it. So really, what we've got here is a live blitz. We've got a live assault of Zeppelin. What there is some very, very interesting sort of early mixes of songs, alternate mixes, and alternate versions of songs too. Maybe it'll take another 20 years for those things to come out. But it's something that I'd really like to listen to them all again and just see. But of course, you know, there's quite a movement, and I'm helping to promote it towards 5-1, and so that's another area with the studio albums. But it's all in time. We'll see what unfolds.
I don't know how I'm gonna tell you. I can't play with you no more.
How do I see Led Zeppelin today? I see it as a period of my life that was absolutely captivating. The excitement and the capacity to take what limited skills and craft I'd got and to find this kind of bed of this small nest of musical style and quality and energy that just happened to make it work for my bit too. But you do what you do. You contribute, you try. Your contribution is almost like some kind of diagonal input. It kind of meets the music and then blends and melds with the music to become the song. So I look upon it as a time of great romance, of me coming of age as a guy and as an adult, coming from a kind of bolshy adolescence into a very tough, cohesive, and at least initially, into a strong combination of guys, which really took me to places I never even imagined. It drew so much potential out of me that I didn't know I had. Because in all the work prior to that, I'd always been way ahead of everybody else. And in Zeppelin, I was just part of it. You know, I could never control it or contain it. And that was the great thing about it. That's why it was so satisfying when it was what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, but nothing like I used to when I was like a teenager and stuff, because it never left my side, the guitar, at all, unless it was confiscated at school. It was true. I mean, I spent all the time playing it. I've got three young children at the moment, and actually playing with them is full-time occupation, let alone playing the guitar. So, you know, you have to fit things in accordingly. Of course I play at home. I heard all these rumours that we were going out to tour, and one thing that I'd said consistently throughout this project was that I really wanted to have a sort of blitz of this material that nobody had heard apart from if a few collectors had it on bootleg, but never did they have it in this sonic quality ever, and or visual quality, you know, and to me that was so exciting. But and there was a sort of hint that came through about, I think one of the members might even have mentioned it, about let's put out one of the, let's put out the CD and then go out and do a live thing and promote the DVD live, playing live. And I said, you know, maybe because I was a lot closer to it, maybe all the way through, but certainly over this period in the studio, I said, one thing that I definitely don't want to do or be seen to be doing, because it would be open to ridicule, would be going out there and promoting something you did 30 years ago. A live performance, going out playing live, promoting something you played live 30 years ago. I thought, if anybody else did it, it did that in particular, to promote a DVD from back in the 60s or early 70s, I think I'd be pretty scathing about it. And I would expect people to be pretty scathing too. So I'd always said, no. Let's put this out and then we'll see how it does. And then once the dust has settled, so to speak, then we'll see how whether we're still talking, whether we can go in a room and maybe pick up some instruments. But I'm not doing that just because somebody tells me I'm touring. Absolutely not. I'm not going to do that because I don't really know how well we're getting on together. I'm not closing it down. I'm just saying that I would really like to have a little space and a break between all of this before thinking about going in a room just because someone tells us we're supposed to be touring.
It's all about having enough time together to be comfortable without it being based just on nostalgia. And just on, it's got to be strong stuff. And I found recently that with Jimmy's work and Jimmy's superlative work on this, painstakingly detailed work on this project, that I've grown into John Paul Jones again. And I think we've both become kind of pals again. So it's good, you know. I mean, do we get on great? Well, I mean, you know, we don't sleep together. We don't have to do anything together, really, except for enjoy what we have had. Because for me as a guy and as a musician, with the time that I've got left, I want to make new inventive music with anybody, really. Absolutely anybody. So this reflection, this retrospective is fantastic, because it reminds me. And it's because it's a lot of the stuff is new to the general public, to me too. It's a real piece of work. It's great to look back at. And I know that the guys I work with were the best in the world.
Things are, you know, taking shape now and getting put into place. And so, yeah, we're all very happy to promote this. It is exciting. It's quite unusual for anything of this size to come out of the Zeppelin camp. Although I said that it probably didn't take relatively that long in the making. You know, it has been the past few years now. You know, there's been whispers and murmurs of live material coming out somewhere. But I'm pleased it's coming out, you know, in this form. It looks real good. It sounds great. And I think it gives a true flavour of what Zeppelin was all about.
Hi, this is Robert Plant, giving you a behind-the-scenes look at How the West Was Won.
Hi, this is Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, giving you a behind-the-scenes look at How the West Was Won.
Hello, I'm John Paul Jones. Welcome back to our behind-the-scenes look at How the West Was Won.
Hello, this is Jimmy Page, and you're listening to the station that made rock classic. Hi there, this is Jimmy Page. Hold on to your seat, here comes Led Zeppelin. Good morning, this is Jimmy Page. Come on, it's time to wake up and get the lead out.
Hi, this is Jimmy Page, and this DJ is insane. Hi, I'm Jimmy Page, and this is Led Zeppelin. Hello, this is Jimmy Page, and I want to hear some rock and roll. Hi there, this is Jimmy Page. Keep your radio tuned right here.